This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Good afternoon. This is Eben Fowler from Bot Radio Network. Again, I have the opportunity, privilege to sit in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. Tony's traveling. I'm glad to be here and hope you are too. Couple of technical things here. FRC.org/radio is the web address, FRC.org/radio. You can find out lots more information about the program. You can listen to previous programs. And if today's program was just so riveting that you have to listen to it again, you can go back there this evening and listen to it as many times as you want. So that's FRC.org/radio. Tony's Twitter handle is at T Perkins. Mine is at Eben Fowler, EbenFowler. Love to have you comment to either Tony or myself about your thoughts about the program. Well, today our program is we got a whole bunch of either currently serving representatives, members of various legislative bodies across the country, or former. So we've got a full slate there. First up, we're going to be talking about health care reform. And oh boy, that's been in the news, especially today when the Senate failed to pass the skinny repeal, I think is what they were calling it. We'll be talking with in just a moment here with Nan Hayworth. She's the first female physician ever to serve in Congress. She served from 2011 to 2013. In our second segment, we're going to be talking with a good friend of Bot Radio Network, Senator Bob Onder. And Senator Onder was instrumental in getting some great pro-life legislation passed in the state of Missouri. And actually, the governor in the state of Missouri, Governor Greitens, took a real strong leadership role in this and brought the both the Senate and the House back, or brought the Senate back, rather, for a session to get this thing done. And it did get done. And it's good stuff. We're going to be talking about that in segment two. In the third segment, we'll be talking about something kind of different. Virginia Delegate Bob Marshall, a longstanding state lawmaker, faces a transgender candidate, and you won't believe how much cash is flowing into that state in an attempt to elect that liberal candidate. Talked with Bob earlier today, and he's fired up and raring to go. He's an interesting guy. You'll look forward to that. And then rounding out the show, final segment, we're hoping to have Congressman Doug Collins of Georgia to join us to talk about a number of different things, healthcare, North Korea. And then he's got a proposed bill concerning justice reform that sounds pretty interesting. Congressman Collins is traveling, and so if we're not able to catch him right at the front of that last segment, Delegate Bob Marshall will stay on with us. And then we'll take some of your calls, which is always a joy to do. It's great to talk with our listeners. Well, let's get going here on Washington Watch. Well, it's back to the drawing board for Senate Republicans after their health care bill failed. Three Republicans joined all Democrats in opposing, as I mentioned before, a so-called skinny repeal of Obamacare. Arizona's John McCain, Maine's Susan Collins, and Alaska's Lisa Murkowski. With us now is Nan Hayworth. She was the first female physician to serve as a member of Congress from 2011 to 2013. She's an ophthalmologist. That's one of those big words, an eye doctor and medical professional. And she's an Indiana native. Nan, welcome to Washington Watch.
Great to be with you, Eben. Thank you.
Well, first of all, tell us, for those of our listeners who are not up to date with what just happened recently in the last, whatever, 12, 14, 16 hours with this vote, bring us up to date with what happened.
Well, what happened was that Senate procedure and Senate prerogative stood in the way of the help that millions and millions of Americans across the country deserve and voted for over and over again, as you know, Eben, in the 2010 election, in which I was part of the freshman wave that went to the House of Representatives, in 2012, in 2014, and again in 2016. And why should we have majority in the House, majority in the Senate, and a president in the White House, all of whom are ready, presumably, to pass repeal and replacement of Obamacare, and yet we still couldn't get it done? And, Eben, it has to do with Senate procedure, which I'd be happy to explain more as you see fit.
Yeah, we'll talk about that because it's kind of arcane and confusing, and it's it's kind of like we don't have the right vehicle to get from here to there, and my understanding is that that, and we'll talk about this here in just a minute. But Senator McConnell, and we're gonna hear a montage of audio from him here in just a second. Senator Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, apparently is able, if he wants to make some changes in Senate procedures to see if we can't clear some of this out. But so let's go ahead and roll this sound bite from Mitch McConnell, and then we'll go from there.
They deserve better than Obamacare and its skyrocketing costs. They deserve better than Obamacare and its plummeting choices. They deserve better than the job-killing regulations, crushing mandates, and collapsing markets Obamacare has given them. I'm proud of the vote I cast tonight. It's consistent with what we told the American people we'd try to accomplish in four straight elections. It's time for our friends on the other side to tell us what they have in mind. And we'll see how the American people feel about their ideas.
Well, it is disappointing. And I'm going to make an editorial comment here, Nan, and that is that Obamacare, you could not have designed a worse piece of legislative junk than Obamacare.
Right.
You know, to see where we are sitting right now and all of the, a few of the things that the senator just mentioned about the drawbacks and the negative stuff that came out of Obamacare.
Sure.
And he didn't even cover half of the big problems that legislation put out there, not to mention that one of the guys who was responsible, this brilliant MIT guy who was responsible.
Jonathan Gruber?
Mr. Gruber.
Yeah,
who said that they had to depend on the stupidity of the American people to get this thing passed.
Mm-hmm.
I would say also that depended on the stupidity of the Democrats who didn't read it and who voted for it. So here's where we are. And, I guess all hope is not lost. I mean, you look at this vote and you see that Senator McCain came out and, said that he was not happy with the content of this thing, as well as the other two Republicans. But then, you're not a single Democrat voted to try to change this thing. So what's going on? And why are we where we are?
Evan, I'm gonna give your great listeners across the country a phrase that I'd like them to keep in mind. It just came into my head. Bust the filibuster. If we're going to fix this problem that we deserve to have fixed, it's a dreadful thing. We just heard the litany of terrible things that Obamacare has done to us, even if with the best intentions originally. That's not the point. It has hurt us. We need to bust the filibuster. So, Evan, here's what happened, basically. The Constitution didn't set out the rules of the Senate the way they affect us today. So the Senate has certain rules that it's adopted over the decades. And roughly 100 years ago, they decided to adopt what's called a filibuster on bringing legislation to the Senate floor for a vote. And this filibuster requires that 60 senators have to say, yes, I'm ready to close debate on this piece of legislation and let it come to the floor for a vote. So that means that they have to have basically a majority in the Senate. Yeah, we think of a majority as 51, right? The House of Representatives, where I served,
right,
a majority for major legislation was 51%. Not so in the Senate. A majority in the Senate is 60. Senate can't do math. So even though the Republicans right now are in the majority, it's a thin majority, as we know, they don't want to bust the filibuster. They don't want to get rid of that filibuster on legislation because they like the fact that if they enter the minority again, which frankly, if they don't pass anything on Obamacare and tax reform, unfortunately, they're likely to enter the minority again. But when they enter the minority again, then they too can hold up legislation. It's very easy to hold up legislation. That's all the Democrats are doing. That's all Senator Schumer's doing. He's laughing all the way to the next election. He doesn't intend to help them at all. He can just, they can just withhold their votes.
Let me just say here too, Nan, that one of the, I think one of the resounding results of the last election when such an unusual candidate as Donald Trump was elected was because of this kind of stuff, because you and I and millions of other Americans are quite frankly fed up with spending the kind of money that we're spending to keep those people working and then not getting anything productive done. And to have the and gridlock's good sometimes, you know, it really is. It keeps bad legislation from being passed. Unfortunately, it didn't keep Obamacare from getting passed.
Right. But nevertheless, that's right. You're right. That's why there was such a fuss, by the way, about Scott Brown, because when Senator Kennedy passed away, then the Republicans had an opportunity to have a 41st vote to break the filibuster. That was why Scott Brown was such a big deal in 2000, at the beginning of 2010. Because then the Democrats did not, they had to bring Obamacare to a vote via reconciliation. So once a year, the Senate can bring a bill to the floor under what's called reconciliation. And under that very, again, equally arcane set of rules, very detailed rules, they only need a simple majority of senators to say, yep, let's close debate and vote. Okay, so that's it only takes 51 votes to do that. And that's unusual. But the problem with, and so that's what the Republican majority in the Senate, that's what Senator McConnell's been working on. They're like, okay, well, we're going to pass a bill through reconciliation because we know the Democrats aren't going to be with us. They're not going to let us bring a bill to the floor to vote. We need 51 votes. We can do that. But the terms of reconciliation, which we shouldn't even have to worry about as Americans, you know, just get the job done, as you said, Evan. That's why we elected President Trump. But the terms of reconciliation are so narrow that they can't craft a bill that will actually enable us to get 50 Republican senators on board.
That's right. I have a great great analogy here, Nan. And let's pretend that we're trying to get across a body of water from point A to point B. Let's say from Cape May, New Jersey to Lewis, Delaware, and you need a large ferry to carry all of this stuff, but all they have is a speedboat, and they're trying to load 300 cars on it. It's never going to work. Well, let me ask you another question. A couple of questions. We just have about 2 minutes left here. First of all, you mentioned the Constitution a couple of minutes ago, and I've said this to other guests in the past, but, you know, the Constitution, where in the Constitution does it say that the government is even supposed to provide health care, period? That's question one.
Precisely.
And then number two is, kind of give me a quick sketch after you talk about that, of where you think we should go from here, how we can get some productive work out of this Congress and to get something that's perhaps more market-focused.
Evan, you are exactly right. The Constitution was brilliantly framed. Those who wrote it were prescient and evergreen, and they said the federal government should only do what the states and the citizens cannot do. Therefore, categorically, the federal government should not be managing pensions and benefits. We've gone way beyond that over the years, over the decades, as we all know, and there are certain things that are going to be almost impossible to extricate ourselves from because, you know, people have come to rely on these things, but they're very poorly administered from the federal level. So at least with Obamacare, maybe we have a chance to do something if, and this goes to part two, if we bust the filibuster, and that's what we have to insist that the Senate does. They busted the filibuster on bringing a Supreme Court justice nominee to a vote. That's how they got Justice Gorsuch, and thank God they did, because
we're out of time. Sorry to interrupt you, but we've got to get going here. Thank you so much. Nan Hayworth, a former member of Congress and first female physician in Congress, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Evan.
Coming up next, Missouri is one step closer to protecting the unborn. We'll talk with Missouri Senator Bob Onder when we return right here on Washington Watch.
Every day, Americans put their trust in doctors who have sworn the Hippocratic Oath to do no harm. We expect that the care they give us will honor this oath to the best of their ability. So why would a doctor participate in physician-assisted suicide? It directly contradicts this oath, leaving our people vulnerable to medical practices that lack safety and integrity. Earlier this year, Washington, D.C. joined Washington State, Vermont, Oregon, California, Colorado, and Montana in legalizing physician-assisted suicide. As a physician of over 25 years and a strong supporter of patient rights and access to quality care, U.S. Representative Brad Winstrup has led the charge in Congress to repeal the D.C. law and ensure safeguards are put in place that protect our nation's most vulnerable citizens. To learn more about what Congress is doing on this issue, go to frc.org/speakers. Again, that is frc.org/speakers.
We've always had an interest. God has given us a gift of being able to help a lot of people with their finances and budgets and stuff.
AFA supporters Bernie and Alice Larson met Dan Celia at a Faith, Family, and Finance town hall meeting.
And he answered some questions, and we were thinking about the charitable gift annuities, and we'd never heard of that before, but we thought, well, we'd always wanted to leave some of our money for God, but we didn't know where or how. And we felt like this was put into our laps as answer to our prayers as to what we could do after we're gone.
Bernie and Alice learned a charitable gift annuity from the AFA Foundation would provide them with a monthly income for life, as well as supporting the American Family Association into the future. You can learn more about charitable gift annuities and other financial products at afafoundation.net or call 800-326-4543, extension 345.
And you just can't outgive God.
Here for your encouragement and your walk with God. This is David Wolin with Haven Ministries, inviting you to anchor your day in God's Word. Everyone has a heritage of some kind. It's the things that inform you about where you came from and who you are. And it's interesting, Psalm 127 says that children are a heritage from the Lord, offspring a reward from Him. In other words, when God gives parents children, He's giving them the chance to learn about where they come from and who they are. As parents raise a child, they have an opportunity to gain insight into what it means for them to be a child of God. Just as parents want their kids to trust, obey, and love them, God's heart desires the same. Parents make sacrifices for their children. Our Heavenly Father sacrificed His own Son so we could become children of God. Get fresh insight into God's Word daily with Anchor Devotional. Visit getanchor.com.
You are listening to Washington Watch. This is Eben Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins today on this Friday afternoon. frc.org/radio is the website you can go to find out more about this broadcast and more about FRC. FRC.org is where you'd go to find more about those guys. They're really good. They've been doing great work here in the U.S. of A. for many years, and now under the leadership of Tony Perkins. So, you know, they're very effective. They have a great staff, and if you knew all of the good things they were doing, you'd be surprised and thankful. So be surprised and thankful, okay? Well, earlier this week, Missouri lawmakers approved abortion regulations that critics said could further reduce access to the procedure. That's a good thing, as far as I'm concerned, making the state the latest to tighten abortion laws. A bill enacting new regulations on abortion providers in Missouri was headed, and we'll find out here from Senator Onder in just a moment. The copy here says it is headed to the governor. I believe he maybe has already signed that, and we'll find out here in a moment. With us now is Assistant Senate Majority Leader Bob Onder. He's a St. Charles County, that's St. Charles County, Missouri, Republican. He's also a physician. So, Dr. Onder, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Well, I want to thank you because I know here on Bot Radio Network, you know us pretty well. We've been chasing you around to get interviews to get on the air on our Missouri stations because this is has been such an important effort that's been going on for these last number of weeks. And my understanding is that this all began when the governor decided to call a special session. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. And I would say, Eben, that the Bot Radio Network was a terrific ally in getting the word out on the importance of taking action. Yes, the governor called a special session. We started back in mid-June, and we had to do two things. One is protect pregnancy resource centers from frivolous litigation because the St. Louis City Board of Aldermen had passed an abortion sanctuary city bill that would have made it possible for abortion advocates to attack pregnancy resource centers. And we also needed a special session because an unelected federal judge in the Western District of Missouri struck down Missouri's long-standing common sense safety regulation of abortion clinics that regulated abortion clinics as ambulatory surgery centers. So with that law struck down and with pregnancy resource centers being threatened by these radical actions by the city of St. Louis, we needed to take action. The governor called us in a special session, and I'm happy to say that on Wednesday, Governor Greitens signed that bill into law.
That's right, and that's what I'd heard, is that he signed that thing just, it was still hot off the presses from the vote, as I understand, and he was anxious to sign it, so that's wonderful. A couple of things, but, you know, we don't have too much time, and I've got lots of questions here, as usual, but first of all, tell us what the actual bill does. What are what were the provisions of the bill, and how do they protect the unborn?
Yeah, so one thing it does is protects pregnancy resource centers from in any way being complicit in participating in abortion, including by protecting them from having to hire abortion advocates. This abortion sanctuary city bill passed by the city of St. Louis, a similar bill was passed in Washington, D.C. and in Boston. It's really a radical, narrow National Abortion Rights Action League model bill. So by protecting pregnancy resource centers, it protects the good work that those organizations like Our Ladies Inn, the City of St. Louis, the good work those people do to give women an alternative to choose life for their unborn child.
Well, I do have a question, Senator Onder, about that. You know, as I was reading about this before, you know, before the session was over and as it was in debate, I kept hearing about this sanctuary cities bill, and I never completely understood what part of that so-called sanctuary cities bill had an impact on pregnancy resource centers. Can you kind of peel back the onion a little bit on that in terms of how dangerous it was for pregnancy resource centers?
Yeah, what it would do, Eben, is create a new protected class in discrimination law. And this new protected class would be reproductive health decisions. So now the advocates of the bill were never able to show us where a woman was being fired for using birth control or a woman was being fired because she had an abortion. Nothing like that ever happened. But by creating this new protected class and forbidding discrimination in employment based on this new protected class, what the goal is that an abortion advocate would go in to a pregnancy resource center or maybe a pro-life church school and apply for a job and would loudly announce that he or she advocates abortion and that, you know, if hired, they would advocate abortion in the course of their employment. Well, of course, that's the last thing that a pro-life church or a pregnancy resource center or a pro-life maternity home wants in an employee is advocacy for abortion. So then that abortion advocate would turn around and sue that church or sue that maternity home, sue that pregnancy resource center, and essentially, with the legal resources that Planned Parenthood and the ACLU have at their disposal,
taxpayer dollars.
Well, that's right. Planned Parenthood gets something like $1 billion a year in federal money. That's right, and thanks to our tax dollars, the Planned Parenthood and these radical pro-abortion groups have a lot of resources that would basically sue maternity homes and pro-life pregnancy resource centers out of business. That is really the pernicious thing about that.
I got you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, and of course, Planned Parenthood and NARAL and the rest of that gang, the folks that like to take the lives of unborn human beings and sell their body parts, have been attacking pregnancy resource centers almost in a concerted effort to sully their reputations. And, you know,
well,
so this, right. this doesn't
right.
surprise
yeah.
me at all.
Yeah,
so
no, you're right. Even during the Senate floor debate, there was one particular senator who was a big advocate of abortion who over and over again talked about pregnancy resource centers giving women false information, well, I don't know what false information she's talking about. I think emphasizing the humanity and the life and the inherent dignity of the unborn child, I don't
call that
false information.
Well, Senator Onder, we are out of time. Time goes by so quickly. Thank you so much for the work you did in Missouri, and thanks for joining us today. Coming up next, a Virginia lawmaker's reelection bid is under assault by the LGBTQ.
Making the most of your money, here's Dan Celia.
One of the questions I get all the time is, when should I start receiving Social Security? It's a good question, and it's one that's been wrestled with for years. Of course, there's a lot of viewpoints out there, and my viewpoint is a little bit different than most. The general viewpoint is, look, start collecting Social Security as early as you possibly can. The sooner you start, the more you're going to end up with in the long run. That's an okay viewpoint, I guess. If you are thinking about, well, I'm 62 now, I'm going to start accumulating some wealth. Too late. It's not the time to be thinking about that, in my opinion. From a personal perspective, I'm not going to start collecting Social Security, Lord willing, until I'm 70. And I'm going to receive 31% more money every month by waiting till I'm age 70. See, here's the thing. You need to change your focus. Forget about how much you're going to accumulate or how much you're going to get out of the government if you live a long time. And start thinking about the only thing that matters, and the only thing, trust me on this, that's going to matter to you, is, do I have enough income to pay my monthly expenses? It's all that should matter. The only thing that should matter is receiving, collecting as much fixed income as you possibly can. I think it pays to wait, as long as you possibly can. Take that Social Security at a later date. Oh, I know overall you're not going to receive as much, but I guarantee you, as your monthly expenses go up, you'll appreciate the fact that you have more income every month coming in because you waited. Ultimately, that's all you're going to care about.
Experience Dan Celia in person. Find a faith, family, and finance town hall meeting or seminar near you at afafoundation.net.
There we are on a lovely Friday afternoon. This is Washington Watch. Evan Fowler from Bot Radio Network sitting in for Tony Perkins today. Glad to have you along. Well, a transgender former journalist pulled off a surprise victory in a Virginia primary in July, winning the Democratic nomination to face off against Delegate Bob Marshall in the general election. Bob was first elected to the Virginia House of Delegates in 1991. He's a strong conservative, and he fights for Virginia values. Delegate Marshall, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So tell us what's going on here, a little bit about maybe your background in a delegate's a little bit different name. Is that kind of a Virginia thing?
Well, we're called delegates here, and they're called delegates in Maryland. It's an old term. It's what you would call a representative in another state, or in New York or California, you'd be called an assemblyman.
Right, right.
So it's the same function. We serve in the largest body of the General Assembly. There's 100 members in that body.
Well, first of all, I understand that you have been attacked by the LGBTQ, et cetera, and the number of initials keeps growing, but apparently you've been under attack from that part of the world. Why is that? What's going on there?
Well, because I do not think that you can alter marriage. I don't think that you can change your sex. I've studied enough biology to know that DNA doesn't lie. Biology isn't bigotry, and I also taught grammar, so I'm comfortable, and I think using pronouns appropriately based on the sex of the individual. I did I authored the marriage amendment in Virginia. I authored a statute before that that said we're not going to recognize out-of-state civil unions. I put in a statute that said when Mr. Obama wanted to change the rules that had been in effect since George Washington, we would not accept practicing homosexuals in the Virginia National Guard. Now, there's a difference in somebody who engages in behavior and somebody who has an inclination. You can have an inclination to a lot of things. You don't act on it, fine.
Well, and let me ask you, because this is related, and that just Wednesday when President Trump dropped his tweet about what will be a new policy for the United States military, which sounded like kind of an all-inclusive or all-exclusive, if you want to look at it that way, pronouncement that those who are transgender will or who identify as transgender will not be allowed to serve in the military in any capacity. Now, there are some nuances, and I think there's some rules that will be coming out, because apparently there are a number of these folks who are currently serving and apparently not causing issues. I guess the big issue was when President Obama said, hey, if you're transgender, you can join the military and we will pay for all of the things that you need done, surgery, counseling, drugs, et cetera, et cetera. What do you know about that? What's the update on that situation?
Well, I mean, so far all I've seen is a tweet. I haven't seen a policy change. In fact, I called our National Guard, the adjutant general, and asked, what are they going to do? They said, well, we're going to wait for a formal order because they can't make changes based on newspaper pronouncement. They've got to have a order from the commander-in-chief. That hasn't come out. But let's go back. The term transgender, it can include somebody who in the morning is a biological male, decides to have a fantasy that they're a female in the afternoon and then goes back but never acts on it, never takes drugs, never changes clothing, never wants to be recognized by feminine pronouns. It also can include people who do take the drugs to take on the appearance of the opposite sex. It can include people who've undergone surgery. So when you say transgender, you're covering a multitude of examples. So when the discussion as to how many transgendered people there were, I read reports from 2,600 to 16,000 within the space of 24 hours. So clearly the language is not being used in any uniform fashion.
Yeah, and that's within the military, theoretically.
Correct. Right, in the right U.S. Armed Services.
And I saw a figure that was somewhere in the realm of 4,500, and if you divide that into 1.3 million, you get a decimal of 0.001 something or other. So, you know, who knows what it is. And, these are folks, and I will say we need to be compassionate. We need to pray for people who are, in that world. A lot of people make fun of them, but we need to pray for them as Christians. But we also need to have sound public policy that makes sense. So tell us about, we have just about 2 minutes here. Tell us about this upcoming race that you have and about your opponent.
Well, my opponent and I are on opposite sides of whether or not you're going to have girls take showers with the boys in public schools or the changing areas or the locker rooms or the bathrooms. My opponent underwent what is called a sex change. It's a sex appearance change. And but wants to be known as a female and says that you're misgendering him if you say that he's a he. So, that's, I guess, one of the crimes I've committed. But clearly the effort is paying off. My opponent received $35,000 from this individual from Milwaukee, who didn't pay state taxes, income taxes, for 14 years, Chris Nobelli. Matter of fact, he was in the White House when President Trump made his announcement, and he pulled his cell phone out and donated $50,000 to my opponent. That makes $85,000. Before that, 78% of all the money had come to my opponent from out of state. You can do an awful lot of fabricating of a record with that much money, and I suspect more is going to come in. This was identified as the race of the year in Time magazine. This was broadcasted all over the United States through the homosexual supporters within NBC. They've got a group in New York called NBC Out.
Really become a nationalized race. Well, Bob, we're going to keep you on the line here because our next guest, as I understand, is traveling, and if you have agreed, if we're not able to get in touch with Congressman Collins,
sure,
you're going to stay on board, and we're going to keep going because there is lots more we can talk about. So we'll be back here in a couple of minutes to continue having a conversation with somebody, either Bob or our next guest. And Bob, thanks so much.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of American Family Association and American Family Radio. One of the places we visit on one of the days on our tour of Israel is the Shepherd's Fields. Now, this is a place in Bethlehem. You can look out on any given day and see shepherds with their sheep, as if it were 2,000 years ago during the birth of Christ. So that's a very special place that we visit. kid. The terrain would be the same. You can just picture yourself being there the night the angels sang about the glory of the coming of the Lord. That's just one of the places we visit on one of the days. So if you would like to join us on our March 8th through the 16th tour of Israel, we'd love to have you. Just go to the website twholyland.com for more information. twholyland.com, or for a free brochure sent to you in the mail, call us at 800-FAMILIES. That's 1-800-FAMILIES, F-A-M-I-L-I-E-S, option 5.
Consider serving with Friendships. It's an all-volunteer ministry providing aid to disaster victims, refugees, and the impoverished here at home and around the world. We're now taking applications. If you're available to serve without pay, you can be part of the crew reaching out to help people in need. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
The American Family Association invites you to help us make In God We Trust more than a slogan. Since 1977, the American Family Association has been a voice to remind America that the blessings of our nation have come from God's gracious hand. You can order In God We Trust wristbands to share at afastore.net. That's afastore.net. Why not get 40 wristbands in honor of the American Family Association's 40th anniversary?
In America today, religious freedom, national borders, and even traditional gender roles are in peril. With all that's happening in our world, our nation is in desperate need of a return to conservative values. Hello, I'm Buddy Smith, Senior Vice President of American Family Association. One of the best ways we can make a difference is with our vote. That's why each year the American Family Association is a sponsor of the Values Voters Summit to help increase cultural engagement. This year's Values Voters Summit will be October 13th through the 15th in Washington, D.C. The growing list of confirmed speakers includes people you hear on AFR like Ed Battagliano and Tawny Perkins, as well as Michelle Bachman, George Barna, Gary Bauer, the Benham Brothers, and more. The Values Voters Summit is sponsored in part by AFA Action. To learn more and to register, you can visit valuesvotersummit.org.
Well, we're in the home stretch of this Friday's Washington Watch broadcast. Evan Fowler from Bot Radio Network sitting in for my friend Tony Perkins. Glad to do it and glad to have you folks along. I'm going to throw out the phone number because we hope to take some of your calls here in this final segment of the broadcast. 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. Our last guest, Congressman Doug Collins, isn't with us yet. If he's able to join us, we will do a little transition right to him. But for the moment, Virginia Delegate Bob Marshall is on the line. Bob, you still with us?
If I said no, would you believe me?
It'd be a little odd. It sound like an answer,
right. Right.
One of those answering machines, you know, that trips
right.
You up. Well, so what we were talking about, Delegate Marshall in Virginia is facing an individual who's a transgender candidate. This is kind of an unusual situation. Bob has also been castigated by the LGBT community for his stand on marriage and also on things like, you know, what gender goes in what restroom. You know, it's silly that we should even have to talk about that, but we've gotten to that point. So tell us a little bit more about the race. You were saying that your opponent has been getting big dollars from outside of your district, not only outside your district, but outside of the state, because this election has kind of become nationalized. Talk about that a little bit more.
It's become nationalized because my opponent wants to be the symbol for all oppressed transgender people to show the world that they can take on someone who has championed social conservative values, and I have. I've been called the four-star general of the culture war with respect to abortion. I devised the original Hyde Amendment with a friend of mine. I have never yielded on this. I worked in Congress for 6 years. These things are very important because if you look at the New Testament, the question comes back, man does not live by bread alone. And that is the case. While the economy is very important, the social issues, the aberrations from the natural law and the laws of nature and nature's God are in fact costing us much money. So my opponent is out here denigrating me for dealing with social issues, yet broadcast as the transgender candidate. It's a bit of a contradiction, and at least I would say that with the addition of the $50,000, by the way, I was outraised 20-1 in the last month. That's about 90-some percent of his money is from LGBT, whatever the alphabet goes, sources, and mine's just from people around Virginia here. So this is a race where they want to use me as the poster boy if they can beat me.
Sure.
Take my picture, shove it in front of people, all of delegates and representatives all around the country. So don't stick your head up. Look who we beat. Because I've beaten people who've outspent me 6-1, but never 20-1.
Well, we will hope that that you prevail. And, you know, money's not everything. You know, your constituents know you well. And Congressman Collins has been able to call in. So Virginia Delegate Bob Marshall, best of luck. We'll pray for your race coming up. And thank you for joining us today on Washington Watch. We appreciate what you do.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, coming up here now is Congressman Doug Collins. He serves the 9th Congressional District in Georgia. He also serves on both the House Judiciary and Rules Committees. He chairs the Rules Subcommittee of Rules and Organization of the House. We've talked about that one before, that really long name. He's also vice chair of the Judiciary's Subcommittee on Courts, Intellectual Property, and the Internet, and in his spare time, we don't know what he does, but it sounds like he's very, very busy. So thank you for joining us, Congressman Collins.
I'm glad to be with you. I hope all's well today.
Well, it is. And I understand that you have just either are about ready to get on a plane or are getting off a plane. And so we just had a little difficulty connecting with you, but we appreciate you being here.
No problem. We're glad to be here. We're glad it worked out.
Well, we've got some time here to talk about several different topics, and I was intrigued by the justice reform bill that you've been talking about. It's the Prison Reform and Redemption Act. I want to make sure we have time for you to talk about that. So explain what that is and what you hope it will do.
Well, I think what it does is I'm a firm believer, not only as a pastor, as a believer, but also as a chaplain in the military. And I've looked at the world and been around it a long time. And what I found that compassion is not a Democrat or a Republican ideal. It's not a liberal or conservative idea. It's actually God-given. And what I believe is that when people make mistakes and when they have gone in, they're paying their price for those mistakes, that they're still as much of God's children as when they made those mistakes. And my hope is that we can provide a process in which the Bureau of Prisons, through current programs they're already doing and adding to those, that we begin a process of evaluation of them when they first come in so that we can assess their risk of recidivism. Because the idea at the end of the day is that we just simply don't want our prison punishment, but we also know that the vast, vast majority of people who are in prison are going to come out again. So what we're trying to say is let's find those who have a risk of recidivism. Let's look at how we can get them training, education, while they're in prison, doing their time so that they can move from the more costly or hard bed space maybe to halfway houses or redemption centers and move themselves back in so that when they do return, they're productive citizens and do not have to turn back to either the way that they currently got them in there or that they can just be productive citizens in our country. And I believe that is just a way to look at this. I always call it the M&M issue. It's money and morals. It's spending money to put people away that we're truly afraid of, and yet those people that we need to put away because we're mad at, we're also helping them get back on the right way, and it's a moral issue. I believe that everybody has, God's gift of life in them, and that we should do everything we do to uplift that part of their life.
Now, as you said, there are already things going on in the prisons. Tell us a little bit about what those are, and then how would this bill impact that? What additional things would be done along these lines?
Well, the biggest thing that this does is we, instead of sort of looking toward the end of a prisoner sentence or the end of the time that they've been incarcerated and saying, okay, well, we got a little while left here, what are we going to do to help you out? We're going to start this from the day they go in, so to speak, from that early stages, so that we can make an assessment and begin to say, okay, which prisoners are in a position to where we can lower recidivism risk, we can lower those things, giving those skills. And then there's an incentive for the prisoner also to take part in this because there's going to be regular evaluations through their time in prison. And if they earn that risk or lower their risk rating through classes or through addiction issues and things like that, then they can actually encourage their time in to be quick, more quickly moved to, say, like a halfway house or to something else. And again, still serving their time, but doing so in a way that allows them to, you know, maybe move out of a more hard bed space, in which, you know, costs more to keep up, but also it limits in what you can do. So those are the kind of things that we're looking to do in this bill, and it has a great bipartisan support here. This is something that, you know, you talk about Washington and the brokenness, and there's plenty of things I can disagree with my Democratic colleagues, but this is an area where I think we can look at it, and it's worked in Georgia, Texas, places like this that are conservative states that have said, you know, this is a better way to look at this.
That's great. Well, I want to put out our phone number, and I want to ask a specific question of our listeners, and that is, if you have been involved in some kind of prison ministry, I want to hear from you. I want to hear what a little bit about that experience, because most of us have not been inside the walls of a prison. We don't know what it's like. We don't want to know what it's like, but there are lots of folks who are doing wonderful work in the prisons who go in, they donate their time and their efforts, and if you have done that, I'd like to hear from you here in the next few minutes. The number is 866-372-7234, 866-372-7234. So if you've been involved in prison ministry, give us a call. We'll try to get you on the air here with Congressman Collins to talk about that topic. And in the meantime, you also wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on with North Korea, because they launched another one here, and just want to hear your thoughts briefly about that. And then if we get some callers to talk about this prison topic, we'd love to bring them on.
We can do that. I think the biggest issue here is you actually have a toddler, basically, in the way that the leader of North Korea is acting. And the unfortunate part is he is looked upon as deity in North Korea, but he also is really fighting out against the world. And it's going to come to a point, especially with these launches and especially with the acquisition of nuclear, this is something that's got to be addressed. We hope China would help us in that regard, but I think we're going to have to also take it up. That's why we, again, imposed more sanctions upon them. That's we sort of expected him to fire off a missile because he was mad. He's pitching a temper tantrum. But he's got to come into the real world. If he wants to be treated with a respect of the world, then he has to act like a leader who is a leader of a country that wants to be a part of the civilized society. So we're going to continue to watch that. I would highly encourage, you know, people to be in prayer about this. This is an area of the world that is very sensitive, and this acquisition of materials and acquisition of rockets and missiles that are now able to reach farther and farther, and nuclear capabilities as well, are something that the world needs to be concerned about.
Absolutely. Well, as soon as I put out the call for folks in prison ministry, the phones just lit up. I've got Stan on the line from Oklahoma, and he wants to talk about prison ministry. Stan, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you, sir. We have been involved in prison ministry for 20-plus years, and my father was involved with it in passed the torch to a younger person from our church. We're in the process. I had a meeting with the warden and several other people. We're in the process of having a new chapel built at the facility where we've been in ministry for these 20 years.
That is wonderful, Stan. And, you know, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. And we've got a bunch of other people. I just want to hear some quick stories here. So up on the line here next is Ben. Ben's from Texas. He's a correctional officer and works in a chapel. Ben, thanks for calling Washington Watch today.
Yeah, how you doing, sir?
Doing great.
So I just wanted to share my experience, or maybe you had some specific questions. You said people weren't sure what happened actually behind the wall.
Yeah,
and
tell
us. I think it's being an officer who deals with the inmate, what we call them offenders in Texas, but with the offenders who work with the ministry, but also offenders who come in for church. There's two kind of different roads there. There are some who obviously are career criminals who use the ability to go to the chapel as a way to facilitate their criminal endeavors. And then I've actually seen offenders who have changed by a friend of theirs who work as a chapel clerk or work in the chapel as a prison minister, who have changed their lives.
Well, that's fantastic. And again, Ben, thank you so much for what you have done, you know, in working in a very difficult area. I want to bring Andrew on. Andrew is from Texas, and Andrew says his he's been affected by prison ministry. Tell us your story, Andrew.
Well, about 11 years ago, I was locked up for crimes I committed, and I was rightfully accused of those crimes. I had turned to the Lord before I went in to the prison system, but I wanted to keep up with, you know, going to church. So I attended some services, and I found a big problem with the ministries in prison are the other prisoners automatically will target most of the people attending the group as criminal sexual, you know, conduct cases, you know, child molesters, rapists, and things like that. And they look at those prisoners as the only reason they're going to the service is to escape, you know, to a safer place. So automatically most of the services targeted and, you know, labeled.
How has it impacted your life? How has prison ministry, how did it help you while you were there?
Oh, I mean, I've actually helped a lot of, it didn't really help me. I mean, I helped people. A lot of people that were targeted in the way I said, I helped a lot of that change in the prison that I was in. A lot more people looked at it differently, not just a place for sexual offenders to escape, but, you know, people from all different types of, you know, criminal backgrounds came and changed their lives through the ministry.
Absolutely. Well, Andrew, thank you so much. Appreciate you calling Washington Watch. I'm going to take one more quick call. This is from Don. Don is a chaplain in law enforcement. Don, you've got about a minute, and then I want to close out here with Congressman Collins.
Hey, the key thing that I hear, the bills are fantastic. It's the follow through in the prison yard that the staff, the administration carries through with those laws rather than just, all right, we passed the law, we're not doing anything. And when I switched from corrections to law enforcement, I've seen what we need is a revival in our communities. We're losing our culture, and that's why so many people are going into prison right now. We're
Amen.
Not teaching good Christian values.
I agree with you completely, Don. Well, Congressman Collins, you have the last word. We have just a couple of minutes here. Your thoughts about some of the calls you've heard and about particularly that last comment in terms of follow-through in the prison.
Oh, I agree. And again, this is an issue that we're going to be working with, making sure that follow through there. I've been with touring prisons, working with the Bureau of Prisons, and there's a lot of desire. There's some really some good stuff that is happening. It takes a long time for culture to change. And inmates and there's going to be some in there who are, you know, furthering criminal activity, becoming better criminals, if you would. But at the same point in time, we also need to foster the ability to for them to have a chance at redemption for those who will get out and continue that process. But also, my father was a state trooper for 31 years before he retired in Georgia. And I just want to say something. I agree completely with the callers that have called. But I believe what has to happen right now is when we talk about revival and we talk about our values, is the first place is those have to take place is as much as the culture and the world around us. It has to start in the hearts and the minds of families, moms and dads, teaching their children, but also in our pews and in our pulpits, because revival, first, I believe, always comes to the people of God first, and we are a fire that then goes out from there. So, you know, my encouragement is for churches to continue to pray for each and every one of us to find ways each and every day that we can impact the world around us. He commanded us to go into dark places. He did not command us to stay simply in light. So when
That's right.
we look at that, we are salt and light in the world, and I appreciate shows like this. I appreciate those that called in, and we're going to be continuing that fight on Capitol Hill, and we just appreciate the prayers of the people that's listening.
Thank you, Congressman Collins. Well, that's all for today on this Friday's Washington Watch. This is Eben Fowler sitting in for Tony Perkins. Have a great weekend.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C., For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.